Welcome to Luck is Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. President Donald Trump delivered his budget roadmap with a promise to balance the budget in 15 years. And once again, the Environmental Protection Agency found itself in the Trump administration's crosshairs, with the White House proposing to slash its budget by 31%. With this budget, Trump continues his unprecedented assault on protections for clean air, drinking water, national parks, and border communities. Today we talk with former EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, who resigned in August 2017 when it became painfully clear that the EPA she had worked in for 40 years was being gutted by the Trump administration. She's still raising her voice against Trump's refusal to protect the American public from environmental hazards. Betsy, welcome to Luck is Focus.
Well, thank you for having me today.
Well, in preparing for this interview, I came across an article that was in ProPublica at the end of 2017, and it talks about your fight. It was, I guess, one of the last fights that you did at the EPA to protect an effluence regulation that had been 10 years in the making. So I wanted, before we go into these recent budget cuts that Trump is proposing, talk a little bit about the atmosphere at the EPA and how it changed when Trump became president, because you actually had a very long history there, long before he came into office.
Yes, and I had worked under, of course, both Democratic and Republican administrations, and we certainly saw a difference in the past when you went from a Democrat to a Republican administration, but nothing like this. This was a wholesale repeal of all the previous environmental protections that had been put in place, not just to protect the lovely environment that we have, but also really directly impacting public health protections. And we found that it was being done at the request of really just a few of the political donors to the Trump campaign, not even supported by most of the industry people that they purport to be, advocating for.
So who are some of those donors?
Bob Murray of Murray Energy is one of the largest coal barons in the country, and he personally gave President Trump a three-page action plan that listed every single environmental regulation that he wanted repealed and a number of other requirements for coal mining that was done by the Department of Interior and the Energy Department. And right now, the Trump administration is on track to satisfy every one of his requests.
Who else besides Bob Murray? I mean, we often hear about the Koch brothers. I wonder how much they have influenced some of these policy changes.
Well, the big influence from the Koch Industries and also Marathon Petroleum, they are really seem to be the ones behind the Trump administration's repeal of the Obama administration's gas mileage rules. This is the fuel economy rule, where we were going to have, under the Obama administration rulemaking, a progressive increase in the gas mileage that cars and light trucks would have to have. And they have proposed to freeze that at the 2020 levels and not to go any further. Right now, we know that there's been almost all of the automakers have protested that and said that they were going way too far. Honda and Ford, in particular, have disavowed EPA's plan to freeze this gas mileage. And all of the automakers have been very open about the fact they're quite concerned that the Trump administration is planning to remove California's ability to set more stringent standards, which would then, you know, make sure the entire country is on this very frozen, low gas mileage situation.
Actually, what is the importance of California's having had for, I guess, what, like at least 40 years now, more stringent environmental protections than other states in the country?
It's really been very influential. A number of the states, there's actually 13 other states and the District of Columbia that have been following California's lead. And what California has done is really been an innovator, pushing forward the whole automaker industry in the United States to be more and more environmentally conscious. So even when the federal government has not wanted to go as far, having California out there has been really a spur to reducing not only the petroleum purchases by every consumer in the country, but greatly reducing the carbon dioxide emissions that are causing our terrible climate change situation.
So when Trump first became president, I'm being kind of a hopeless optimist. I kept thinking, well, he can't change all these rules because the rulemaking process takes a long time to happen. And what he wants to do, and he's getting rid of these rules, is he has to go through another rulemaking process. But in reading more recent articles, it sounds like he's actually done a bit of damage already. How much of the Obama-era regulations have actually been gutted, and how much of that is just still in process or being litigated?
Well, he has, in the first 2 years, he actually repealed over 40 of them. Of those 40 that he's repealed, he's got another 40 that he's planning for the next 2 years. So there will be entirely a total of 80 environmental regulations that are either going to be blocked, delayed, or targeted for repeal. Now, the way that this is clearly for just a common sense approach, the fact that every one of these 80 regulations usually took about 6 to 8 years to develop, the fact that he could repeal all of them in 4 years clearly indicates that he is not doing this based on science and engineering and economic fact. He is doing it strictly at the request of his donors. Now, right now, we have more than 140 lawsuits have been filed against EPA, but there's only been 27 cases that have reached a final decision to date. And EPA has lost every one but one of those. So they lost 26 cases and only won out of everything that's been litigated to date.
Now, what does it mean by that they've lost it? Is EPA on the side of Trump now, or is EPA still fighting?
Yes, EPA is on the side of Trump. So what has happened is, with that terrible litigation record, that has given hope to every environmental and state attorney general in the country, because we have found that they have been so quick to repeal years and years of regulatory work, that they have not in turn done the adequate science and engineering and economic analysis that justifies those repeals. So when it finally gets to a judge, they're losing one after another. And again, so far the total is they've lost 26 out of 27 lawsuits.
So my optimism is well-founded. That's kind of good to know. Continue, sure.
It's good to be optimistic about the final outcome of the litigation, but you have to realize all of us are experiencing much higher levels of pollution in our air, water, and land during the years that it takes for these court cases to get filed and decided, and then for the environmental and public health protections to be put back in place. So all of us are experiencing real threats to our public health over the next 4 to 8 years while all this litigation takes place and hopefully is resolved somewhere around 2024.
So it seems like there's a couple of different classes, I'm assuming, that there's regulations that were decided during the Obama years but had actually not taken effect yet. But is Trump also trying to repeal regulations that have been on the books for a long time? And I'm wondering about the difference. If a regulation is already on the books, can it just is enforcement ability gutted during the whole litigation period?
That's what he's trying to do. And the one that's the clearest example is the one that he now has proposed to repeal and to adjust, and that's the mercury and air toxics rule. And that rule went into effect in 2012. The entire electric utility sector is opposed to the Trump administration's proposal to repeal this rule because all of them have long since been in compliance. They all agree that mercury and other air toxics pose very serious public health threats. But in this case, Bob Murray, again, the CEO of Murray Energy, has demanded that that rule be repealed. And so the Trump administration is in the process of doing that.
So while,
and again, that rule was final in 2012.
So while that rule is being appealed or trying to be repealed, has it stopped being in effect?
What they have said is right now the electric utility industry, who themselves are opposed to this repeal, they're continuing to operate their air scrubbers to remove mercury and these other air toxics from their emissions. What the concern by Bob Murray is pushing for this to be repealed is that in the future, if this repeal were to go final, people could decide to just turn off the operation of these air scrubbers. It would save them a lot of money. And of course, what Bob Murray is trying to do is to encourage new coal-fired power plants to be put in place. And of course, any new plant would never have to have complied with this rule if it's been successfully repealed. So Bob Murray's trying to keep coal-fired power plants operating because he sells coal.
Let's talk a bit more about this Bob Murray. I mean, his name rings a bell to me. Some people probably have never heard of him, though. Where is he from, and what's the extent of his holdings?
His holdings, he really runs the coal mines in much of Appalachia. And there are two uses for coal. One is to make steel. And right now, that's the one that has some promise because there's a lot of coal exports to China and India and other countries that are in a big building phase. And so they need what's called metallurgical coal to make steel. But his big customer base originally was coal that is burned for power. And he's selling that coal power plant to companies around the country. And of course, that has had enormous decline. They're down to about 30% or less of the U.S. power plants now are fired by coal. And so he wants to reverse that trend and have it go back to coal being one of the main power supplies in the country.
Well, it's kind of interesting because the common wisdom is that coal is going out of style, so to speak. I mean, here in the Northwest, all the coal fire plants are going to be closed in the next 2 to 3 years. Though, interestingly, I did see a coal train the other day as I was crossing the Columbia River, and it looked like it was heading. It looked like it was heading west, and I'm assuming it was probably going up to the Centralia coal-fired plant there. But coal is really, like, in many parts of the country, or at least on the West Coast, it barely exists anymore. And gas is unfortunately seeming to be its replacement, and that's a whole other issue. But it seems that Murray and his allies are actually fighting a real losing battle.
There's no question about that. The Trump administration just tried to stop the Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, which is a government-owned utility, from shutting down several of their coal-fired power plants. And even the TVA people turned them down because these old plants are simply not cost-effective to run anymore. And you're right, in most cases, they are being replaced with natural gas plants. But at the same time, the coal themselves, no one wants to run these plants anymore. They're very expensive, and it's not, in most cases, the environmental regulations which are encouraging the utilities to shut them down. It's actually the cost of operating them.
So why is it that while the industry is by and large opposed to these cutting back and repealing of regulations that have been long in the making to protect our environment and our public health, if they're so much opposed to it, why is it that a few loud voices that have Trump's ear are able to override the will of most of the American business?
Because they are the ones who have donated to his campaign. In many cases, they're the ones who have supplied the political appointees to the Department of Energy, the Department of Interior, and to the Environmental Protection Agency. So their voices are the only ones that the Trump administration is listening to. And I can tell you that is what the shock was at EPA. We realized within the first 6 months of the Trump administration at EPA that this was going to be unlike any other previous Republican administration. It is solely controlled by the political donors who provide all of the funding for his campaign and apparently provide all the source of his political appointees. So it's a very, very corrupt situation.
Yeah, he's been draining the swamp all right there. You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with former EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, who resigned in August 2017 after Trump took over, or Trump's cronies took over the EPA and transformed its mission from protecting the health and environment of the American people to basically destroying it. I'm curious about what it was like in those first few days and weeks and months before you finally resigned in trying to do your job at the EPA with its mission of protecting the country's health and environment, and at the same time watching this transformation that you just started describing.
Well, I think it was kind of heartbreaking in retrospect, because at first we were very, very optimistic. What has normally happened at times of transition, the political team comes in the first few months and they have a lot of, big plans and kind of preconceived notions about how the agency runs and, what they're going to get rid of or what they're going to do new. And what they usually do is spend the first few months just going through each program methodically, having the career scientists and engineers and economists explain the background of all the work. And only then do they start to firm up their plans about what they're going to change or what they're going to do as a new effort. And what this administration did, the very first week that at that time it was Scott Pruitt was the administrator of EPA, instead of meeting with career staff, he went directly to having meetings with the political donors for the Trump campaign. He apparently collected lists of rules that they demanded be repealed immediately, and he just initiated the process of doing those deregulatory actions. So that was the case in my situation, where we had spent 6 years putting in place the first requirements for coal-fired power plants to actually treat the toxic waste that they emitted, instead of just pouring it into these big unlined ponds that frequently broke and contaminated not only the surface water downstream of these ponds, but in many cases leaked into the groundwater below the ponds and contaminated everybody's drinking water wells. So for the first time in 2015, we actually required those coal-fired power plants to treat that highly toxic waste instead of just pouring it untreated into these very unsafe ponds. He immediately decided, based on Bob Murray's action plan, that this was one that he was going to repeal. And Scott Pruitt, the way we found out at the career staff was we saw a draft press release that he asked us to check for accuracy, where he was announcing that he was going to repeal it. So that is why every one of us realized this was not going to be a typical political transition in which the career staff would have a chance to change the political appointees' minds about their plans for the future. And instead, we would just receive directions from the political donors to those to that political campaign.
Well, this ProPublica article that was published in December 2017 starts out with, Betsy Sutherland knew something was wrong the moment she walked into her office at the Environmental Protection Agency. It was 8 a.m. on a Thursday in April, and already her team was waiting at her door, computer printouts in hand. And it sets it up as, I think, a really chilling moment. And I just wonder what you felt like when you came into the office that day and you saw such a different tenor in the office than you probably had experienced in 40 years.
We had never seen a situation in which a major decision for a rule that had been final since 2015. So that meant that rule had been on the books for already 2 years, had it been fully vetted by industry, by the public, by scientists. Everybody was fully, in agreement with what we had done. And to see it just literally overnight, because Bob Murray requested it, it's on the chopping block to be repealed without giving us even 1 hour to talk to him, Scott Pruitt, to try to explain why he would not want to do that, why the claims that Bob Murray made that it was scientifically unjustified and economically too expensive, those were false claims. And we could easily have demonstrated it. And what actually happened was we were not even allowed to talk to Scott Pruitt until late in July, when he had already directed us to do the repeals. So we got 2 one-hour sessions with him in July, and that was done really just as a kind of check-the-box situation, where he said he had met with us, but at that point he had already long since decided that that rule was going to be repealed.
So when Scott Pruitt was appointed the head of the EPA, or just when he was nominated, I wonder what kind of feeling you had, because you must have been pretty familiar with this guy and all the litigation he'd done in his role as Attorney General of, what, Oklahoma, I believe?
Yes, and what we also knew from the press reports was Devon Energy is one of the big energy companies in Oklahoma, and we knew that many of the letters and the litigation that he had filed against EPA rules as the state of Oklahoma Attorney General were verbatim copied from Devon Energy memoranda and letters that they had sent him. So we knew that in the case of his Oklahoma Attorney General, he certainly did everything the major energy company in Oklahoma told him to do. But what we were not ready for, and that's where the shock came in, is that he was also ready to do anything a political donor to the Trump campaign nationwide requested him to do. And without question and without consultation at all with the career staff that had worked on these rules for years.
Now, while you were still at the EPA, were you aware of all the other brewing scandals about Scott Pruitt and just how incredibly corrupt, not to mention incompetent, he is?
Yes, because what happened was EPA is, turns out, is a very small agency. Of course, it's much smaller now because they've been cutting all the staff. But we don't have all the cabinet-level political appointees that they have in the big cabinet agencies. EPA is an independent agency. It's very small. And basically, most of us, I was an office director in the Office of Water, and I worked immediately for the political appointee for water, who in turn worked directly for the administrator of EPA. So very short management chain. And we always had Monday morning meetings to get organized on what was going to be the big effort for that week. Scott Pruitt was never at those Monday meetings because he had, even the whole time I was there, he would go home to Oklahoma and be there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and come back to Washington, D.C., sometimes on a Monday or a Tuesday. So we were well aware from the moment he got appointed that most of his time was going to be spent either in his home state of Oklahoma or it was going to be spent traveling around the country, visiting different oil and gas association meetings or chemical industry meetings or other types of agribusiness meetings to drum up support for the deregulation that he was planning to do.
So at what point did you realize that you could not work within the EPA anymore?
I certainly realized it by that summer. I had family medical issues that I wanted to help out with anyway, and I realized there was literally nothing I could do to change this man's mind about all the public health protections he was going to remove for the American public, that I would not even have the opportunity to even try to influence his thinking. They apparently have, as best as I can tell, detailed list of the rules that they're going to repeal at the request of political donors. And it really doesn't matter what the facts are, either the economic facts or the public health facts. By God, they're going to pursue those deregulatory efforts.
So when you left, I guess you felt like you couldn't do any more there. But I'm just wondering how many people remain at EPA who are still trying to fight and trying to hold some semblance of the agency together.
What I do know for a fact, and that is that, first of all, we have had a tremendous loss of people at EPA. At the end of the Obama administration first term, we were around 17,000 people. We're under 14,000 people now since the Trump administration has been there. And more and more people are doing what I'm doing. They're retiring and then using their voice to help the press and congressional investigations into the public health debacle that we have at the Environmental Protection Agency right now. And we're all willing to put hours and hours of our time now as retirees into educating both the public and the congressional investigators so that people will understand how really devastating these actions are.
Well, you also did something that I think a number, well, some very notable people did shortly after Trump became president and all these strange ties with business started coming out. In your case, your farewell letter, when you made it public, and I understand it went viral. What was in that letter, and why do you think it went viral?
I think it went viral because that was in the first 7 months of the Trump administration, and most people in the public at that point had not figured out that this was going to be such a unique, deregulation machine. I think most people were like those of us at EPA, where we thought, oh, well, you know, they'll change their plans once they come here and when they get all the facts in front of them, and they will certainly modify and maybe have, you know, one or two priorities. What my farewell letter did was alert people to the fact that it was going to be absolutely Katie bar the door, that every single thing a political donor asked for was going to be repealed, and that they were not going to make any effort to try to accommodate the science or the economics involved in these rules. They were just going to flat out do it, and do it at an enormously quick rate compared to previous years spent developing very scientifically defensible rules. So I think that was, it was my explanation to the American public that they should not be optimistic. They should not think there was any hope that they were going to modify their deregulatory stance.
Well, some of the things that you said in it, you said the truth is there is no war on coal. There is no economic crisis caused by environmental protection, and climate change is caused by man's activities. I know in my heart that the majority of Americans in this country recognize that protection of public health and safety is a right and is just. And so this won't happen. And all you must just wait for that day to come, whether it's 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, that day will come. So do not give up. Do not feel that your efforts are going to go to waste in these 4 years, because eventually you will overcome. So you were trying to tell your, and I guess you said that at the farewell party at the EPA, you were telling your colleagues who were sticking out to stick out that much harder.
Absolutely. And what they're doing in every case, they try. They are still trying. I know the people who still work there. I talk to many of them. They are trying every possible way to keep providing the facts, the science and the economics behind this, these rules that are being repealed. And in every case, they are still given the same direction that I was given back in 2017, which is, thank you very much, but we're going to do this. And it's whatever the political donors ask for, they're going to get. And it's no difference under Andrew Wheeler than it was under Scott Pruitt. No one has seen a difference in terms of the direction of the agency.
Well, one of the things that's been notable in the Trump administration is that Trump has very openly appointed cabinet secretaries and other people in charge of agencies that in many cases, their whole modus operandi, their whole career has been to undo the regulations that these agencies do. And Scott Pruitt was, of course, a great example. But let's talk about the current director of EPA and what his associations are.
Well, of course, he's a former coal lobbyist and actually worked directly for Bob Murray. In fact, we know from press reports that he met with Secretary Perry at Department of Energy before he was appointed as the deputy administrator of EPA, representing Bob Murray. And that's where Bob Murray presented his action plan for the Department of Energy under the Trump administration, with Andrew Wheeler right there as his co-lobbyist. So he has a long career promoting oil and gas and coal, and he is not going to be dissuaded by any science or economic facts that the career staff present to him. So he is certainly not doing the, you know, 24/7 security details and the fancy hotels and international travel that Scott Pruitt did, but he is doing every last one of the political donor requests just as Scott Pruitt did.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with former EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, who resigned from the EPA in 2017, has now become a very loud, outspoken critic of what's going on in that agency under the Trump administration. Well, I remember right after Trump became president, and I don't remember which agency this is under, but I know that the websites that had anything to do with climate change were all taken down. Was that EPA or was that?
That was EPA. Yeah. And what was sad about that, EPA had spent decades building that website so that it was known in universities throughout the world that that was the go-to one-place site that you could go and really get connected to the world's literature on climate change, all the newest studies, all the newest findings. It was a kind of a one-stop shopping place to get all that climate change information really synthesized and consolidated and linked to all the original articles that were really of worldwide significance. So when that website got taken down and, you know, is still not replaced the way it was, it was a huge loss to the whole world who depended on it for this very important update of all of the studies that are being done really worldwide on the effects of climate change and better predictions of how fast climate change is occurring, what it is most sensitive to. All that very critical information has been lost.
Well, I remember just in the last days of the Obama administration, stories about how there were employees in the EPA and I think also the Department of Energy and Department of Interior that were just downloading as much data as they could from the government websites before they were taken down. Do you know how much data actually got preserved and what happened to it?
In the case of EPA, I'm not familiar with the other agencies, but all of it was archived. So they have that available. It's just not available to the general public, but it has been downloaded and archived. And I think this is going to be the next wave, the next 2 years of the Trump administration now is really going to work on undermining the scientific foundation of all of EPA's work. And the reason they're going after the scientific foundation now, like these websites that have all this global study information available, is because they are losing in litigation. And the reason they're losing in litigation is because they do not have new science or new economic analyses that justify their repeals. So what they're now trying to do under Andrew Wheeler is to go back and undermine the way we use science at EPA and the way we do economic analyses. So they've got three big efforts underway that Andrew Wheeler is heavily involved in. Number one, they've replaced all the university professors on all the agency science advisory boards with either industry scientists or state scientists who are openly opposed to environmental regulation. Number two, they have insisted they're going to go final on a rule to prohibit EPA's use of any scientific studies which protect the private medical records of participants in these studies. That's going to eliminate many of the very critical public health studies that EPA relies on for past public health regulations and for any future public health regulations. And then number three, they've proposed with this mercury air toxics rule that they're going to prohibit EPA from counting certain benefits of their regulations. And so that will eliminate EPA's ability to justify many of their regulations based on monetized benefits of public health effects. So they're really going under Andrew Wheeler, they're really going after the scientific and economic benefit underpinning of all the regulations to not only justify the current deregulation that they're doing, but also to paralyze the agency's rulemaking for the future.
Well, the first concern you raised, which is basically to try to undermine the science that's behind making the regulations that you've been involved in all these years, is one of the biggest concerns that I've had watching the same issue coming up here in the Northwest. We're fighting really bad information about the benefits of frack gas and infrastructure that's being planned in Washington and Oregon. And that there's a lot of bad information that comes out in the environmental impact statements that are basically written by industry consultants for local governing bodies who are the lead agencies in deciding whether these infrastructure projects can pass muster. For me, it's been really amazing to watch scientists like either consciously lie or use what they know is bad data. And I wonder how we counter that, because it seems in this age where just a couple weeks ago Trump passed the 10,000 lie milestone, that lying is becoming more and more acceptable. But to me, it's really concerning when scientists either lie or allow their data to be misused.
It's shocking. And the people that Andrew Wheeler has appointed to the science advisory boards that have the official role of advising EPA on the scientific foundation of their regulations are really far outside the mainstream in terms of their scientific viewpoints. So he has a one guy, Calabrese, who thinks that actually a little bit of radiation really makes you healthier. A little bit of pollutants probably has the same effect. And really, you have to be at high levels of radiation or high level of pollutants before you would really have any public health effects. I mean, this is not mainstream science. This is it's very bizarre theory. And he has appointed all of those types of scientists to these very important advisory boards that EPA in the past has always relied upon to give very unbiased, most up-to-date scientific advice to the agency. So the only way that Congress so far has come up with to try to counter this, there is a Scientific Integrity Act that has been proposed, in both House and Senate bipartisan support, where they're trying to have some kind of requirement that every federal agency allow their scientists to be able to speak out without political repression. And so right now, to my knowledge, that is the only congressional attempt to try to fix this for the future. But again, between now and the next presidential election, we're just going to have to continue to raise public awareness that the statements that are being made are factually incorrect.
And that's my big question, is how do we raise public awareness? I mean, how do we have a mouthpiece as big and as loud as Fox News that actually talks about scientific truth?
And that's what every environmental group that I'm aware of in the country, as well as, you know, this group of retirees that I work with, the Environmental Protection Network, that's what we really are spending all our time doing. We have to reach the press. Radio shows like yours are so important, because a lot of people now don't have local or regional newspapers that cover these issues. So we really need to get to radio, we need to get to TV, as well as every print press we can get a hold of, to try to explain over and over again what is the truth, what is the real scientific finding that underlies the actions these guys are trying to repeal. And that's the only way I know we can do it, because I really feel that they have cooked the books to such an effect, with all their spokespersons being outliers in the scientific community, and yet acting as if they're speaking authoritatively for the current state of science in the country. It's shameless on their part, but it's up to those of us who know better to make sure we use every mechanism possible to inform the public.
Well, I find that I see this like playing out on the local level, because what happens at the federal level can become sort of a role model for local governments. And in very rural communities here, like in Coos County and actually three other counties in Southern Oregon, where they are going to be impacted by this proposed largest, actually the first and largest LNG export facility on the West Coast. And there's a lot of opposition to it, but the county governments are basically controlled by the company that wants to build the LNG terminal. And there's this, so much money that gets thrown at, you know, influencing local governments. The same thing's happening in Southwest Washington, where there's the world's largest methanol refineries being proposed. And so watching the way that people who are local government officials who become the lead agencies in determining the environmental impact statements for these facilities, when they don't have much information and they can be influenced so easily by the industry and they don't know that they're even being lied to, or they don't care because there's some kind of financial benefit. I just wonder, I mean, I've been watching this unfold here for the last few years, and I wonder how to get the story out to the local people who so they can understand how they're really being taken by these local officials, by these national and international businesses that are just trying to basically extract stuff from their communities and export it elsewhere. How does that translate from the work that you're doing to communities across the country, which are facing the same kind of industry intrusion on their way of life?
It's absolutely happening at every level of our government. And the what's happened right now, we have to fight back at the ballot box. That's our only hope. I mean, we can do everything possible to have press reports and radio and TV try to correct the record. But in the end, the real fight is at the ballot box. People have got to, any apathy that you would ever have had in the past, you need to get past that and get out there and vote, because we, right now, the polluters have taken over both federal, state, and local government. And unless those of us who understand what they're doing don't get, we've got to get active, and we've got to call them on it, because there is no to their greed. They will take every dime they can out of this country and not worry for a second that they're exposing our children, even our unborn children, to mercury levels and toxic levels. They don't care, as long as today's profit or next year's profit is even bigger than what they had when they were forced to actually control their pollution. And that brings me back to the budget cuts that the Trump administration proposed for 2020. They make a big point that the reason they're gutting the EPA staff and the EPA budget is because they really believe in states' rights, that states and local governments are where the action is, and that's who they trust to handle the environment. And yet, their own budget for 2020, they cut the state and local environmental program support by almost 50%. It was $500 million they cut from them just in 2020. And so it's a false statement they make when they say they really want to support state and local government. They're really trying to undermine them, just as they have undermined the federal government.
Well, I understand that the Trump administration, Trump issued an executive order not that long ago trying to override states' abilities through their own environmental protection to stop pipelines, gas and oil pipelines.
That's right. It's a very important, it's actually part of the Clean Water Act. It's called this Section 401 of the Clean Water Act, where states have to certify that major federal permitted projects meet their water quality standards. And so when you have pipelines that are going to contaminate the surface and groundwaters of a state, the state has in the past, under this 401 certification authority, can say, no, you either can't do the pipeline or you have to make changes so that you don't contaminate my water quality. And he wants to put real constraints on that, real short deadlines for states to review projects. And if they don't speak up in time, the project goes forward. Many, many constraints on that state authority. So again, they keep saying they're real proponents of state and local government. But whenever a state wants to be more stringent than the Trump political donors want, then he's not in favor of state empowerment. That's why he doesn't want California to have the ability to have more stringent tailpipe emissions. And he doesn't want to let any state in the country to be able to protect their water quality through this pipeline certification process.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with former EPA staffer, Betsy Sutherland, and she resigned from the EPA in August 2017 so she could actually get out and do some important work of basically exposing what the EPA has turned into under the Trump administration. And you're listening to KBOO Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. I want to talk a bit more about the impact of what you just talked about of limiting the state's ability to use the 401 Clean Water Act to protect local communities from the dangers of pipelines. I mean, I mentioned this LNG export terminal that Jordan Cove wants to build in Jordan Cove in Coos County in south along the southern Oregon coast. And they just, the Department of Environmental Quality here in Oregon just denied the 401 clean water permit for Jordan Cove. And this is, they actually have the opportunity to go and reapply because it was denied without prejudice. But it was seen as a real big setback for Jordan Cove, who's been trying for 15 years to build this, not only this huge LNG export terminal, but also a pipeline that would feed the natural gas to the terminal that would cross most of southern Oregon, and it's over 200 miles long. So there's so much opposition, and the state actually is starting to show some movement in terms of finally denying this facility for good. But I'm wondering if there's a deadline, like how much time the state has to actually use its authority to stop the pipeline before the Trump administration could actually come in and just shut things down here.
Well, I think they need to move right now, because the way they're headed now on the 401 certification process is to put many constraints on the state authority. And what I think has been happening is, unless we get the general public more motivated, you know, if local government or state government is allowed to go unchecked by public scrutiny, these things are going to go the way that the polluters want. And it's great in your state and the state of Washington that you have a lot of elected officials who are very environmentally responsible. And so I think just some additional public scrutiny. Right now, the changes to the 401 certification process are just proposed, but I'm sure they're going to move out on those rapidly, as they have on all their deregulation and efforts, and that's probably going to be during this year, 2019. So I would think people just need to get really active and make sure their elected officials in local and state government know that they don't want this to happen.
In the case of Oregon, the Department of Environmental Quality had extended their deadline for deciding on the permit to September, but then decided to move it up, and they decided 2 weeks ago. Part of it was that they weren't sure if the extension of the deadline was actually going to be considered legal by the EPA. My sense was that they feel the pressure and the urgency to really act and to try to stop this before it happens. And then there's another big permit that the Department of State Lands in Oregon also would deny or permit, the removal fill permit. The other side that's kind of interesting, in Washington State, Jay Inslee has finally come out against the two frack gas projects, a large LNG hybrid facility in Tacoma and the world's largest methanol refinery in Kalama. And just last week, he proclaimed his opposition to both of those projects as he was signing a very major environmental and climate action bill in the state of Washington. They have different state laws here in Oregon and Washington. And in Washington, they're really relying much more on the feds, but then they also have their own state Environmental Policy Act. And I wonder how much clout they will have if the EPA were to start putting the clamps on state autonomy.
It's going to be a struggle for everybody. The way they want to run this state certification process is to really put a tight deadline of 30 days on the states. And what many states are saying now, sometimes these permit reviews at the state level do go on a long time. And so industry, you know, certainly has room to complain about the timing. But usually it is because the state is not being, you know, negligent or whatever. It's because the original application doesn't have all the environmental data that the state needs to make a decision about letting the project go forward or not. And so what the state would say is, you can give us deadlines, but not until we say that the application is complete and the clock should start ticking at that point. what the Trump administration wants to do is say the minute somebody puts the first piece of paper in front of you and says they want this project approved, you have only 30 days to respond to that. And that's why I'm saying it's a huge constraint and a pressure on states who have these very, very complex projects that extend over many, many miles, that they have to analyze every possible environmental aspect in such a short period of time when the application itself may be missing some of the most critical information. So it's being done to force these pipeline projects to go forward without state approval.
I mean, the thing is really disturbing in the case of Jordan Cove and also in the case of Northwest Innovation Works in Kalama. They just lie. I mean, they have absolutely no information, no basic science in their original applications. They lie about the purpose. They change the purpose. The LNG facility in Jordan Cove was originally going to be an import facility. They turned it to an export facility. And that's why it's been going on for 15 years. It's not because of the bureaucracy and the obstructionist aspects of state regulations. And I wonder if there's a way to... I mean, I guess getting that information out so people realize that it's not because states have too much regulatory processes that are an obstruction to having a good business climate. It's because these businesses are trying to take advantage of states and of the communities that would be impacted basically by lying and obfuscation and any other way they can to make a buck.
Right, because I think, I mean, we do have in the U.S., this is a typical complaint, you know, I'm from the government and I'm here to help you, and everybody rolls their eyes. So when the industry makes the complaint that, you know, the state's just sitting on their permit, they won't take action, it's people tend to be sympathetic that, you know, oh, it's just the bureaucracy, it's a bunch of, you know, lazy guys just not taking action on something. When in fact, in many cases, they have not been given adequate data for the state analysts to even have a chance at predicting properly whether the pipeline project is going to cause problems or not. So it's not negligence or laziness or, you know, bureaucracy that's causing the problem. It's an inadequate application to begin with.
Well, in the last part of this hour, I'd like to talk some more specifically about the budget cuts, which was the ostensible reason that we're having this interview today. But to talk about exactly how these budget cuts, why they're so alarming and how they would really be impacting the EPA's ability, if it cares anymore, to protect our health and our environment and our welfare here in the United States.
Well, I think this is perfect time for us to talk because this week, the House is actually discussing in the Appropriations Committee an alternative to the Trump budget. And believe me, it is a big alternative. And it looks like it's going to have at least some bipartisan support. But let me just first talk about what the Trump 2020 budget. They made an unprecedented cut in EPA, but not just for the EPA dollars and staff levels, but unprecedented cuts for all the state and tribal environmental programs. So that's what I really need to focus on in the short time that we have left. And what they did was EPA was cut more than any other agency in the federal government by the Trump administration. It was over a 30% cut. But what they did to states and local governments is they cut almost 50% of all the money that goes to the state and local governments for their environmental programs. And, of course, if anybody that's been following the news, EPA and the states really work in a partnership. So EPA, generally, their role is to establish national standards to ensure that there's clean water and air and land that is nationally consistently clean across the country. And then the states implement those standards by issuing permits and carrying out inspections and enforcing the laws and regulations. So when state budgets are greatly cut like they are today in the environmental program, they've come more and more to depend on the funding that they get from EPA to be able to continue to enforce and protect the public's health by issuing permits. And they depend on this money from EPA. They cut the Trump administration $500 million from the states. They basically eliminated all their targeted airshed grants for highly polluted air areas. They eliminated indoor radon grants. They eliminated the lead cleanup grants. They eliminated all the stormwater pollution grants for non-point source pollution, all the priority watershed grants except for Chesapeake Bay and Great Lakes, and they cut them by 90%. They also took all the loan programs to build new or updated drinking water utilities and cut those by over 25%. And all the loans for newer expanded sewage treatment plants by over 30%. So it was a stunning reduction in all the state support. And then at EPA, they cut all the staff back. They want to cut them back to 12,000 people. They want to have massive cuts in all the research, all the drinking water programs, clean water programs, hazardous waste programs. And so it's not just the climate change programs that's being eliminated. It's the entire infrastructure of technical assistance and financial assistance that EPA provides to the country.
So the last time that Trump tried to cut the EPA budget, it didn't pass in Congress. Are you hopeful that Congress will have a very different budget that will fly instead?
So right now, and that's why the timing is perfect for this talk, actually this Wednesday, the House Democrats will be talking to the entire Appropriations Committee about their budget for EPA. And instead of keeping the EPA budget constant, which is what has been happening, Trump proposed these kind of draconian cuts, you know, every year he's been there. And they always just say, oh, EPA what they had last year, the level amount, and not do any cuts. But this time, the Democrats are actually asking for an increase in EPA. They want to increase them from the $6 billion that Trump was asking for to $9.5 billion. And of course, not only are they going to restore all these geographic programs, but they want to give the states nearly $2 billion more than Trump had asked for. So we've got high hopes that, you know, again, this will go to the full Appropriations Committee this Wednesday, May 22nd, and then the House will vote on it in June.
So there's some hope.
There's some major hope, at least for the funding to states. I think EPA will still be badly hurt because Andrew Wheeler will continue to let the staff dwindle down to a very low level, and he will continue to deregulate all the public health protections that we had, but at least the states will be able to run their drinking water, clean air, and clean water programs with some funding.
And you'll be keeping an eye on them and letting us know what's going on.
Absolutely. Happy to talk to you anytime.
Great. Well, it's really good talking with you, Betsy. I really appreciate it. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking today with former EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in, you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll hear an interview I conducted with Bill McKibben on May 8th. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by Aretha Franklin. Thanks for listening.
Change, change, change.